Hi and welcome. I'm Dr. Juhi Moon, and I would like to thank you all for joining us for this educational activity. It's entitled Panviral Screening for Hepatitis B, Hepatitis C, and HIV in Diverse Practice Settings. CME Outfitters is a joint accreditation provider and develops and certifies continuing education activities with the motto of For the Team, By the Team, including our program today. Today's program offers several types of CME and CE as listed here. So while not anticipated, we will disclose any off-label uses of products or devices mentioned during our discussions as well as the Q&A session. So again, I'm Dr. Juhi Moon. I'm an assistant professor at the Division of Infectious Diseases at Johns Hopkins University. I work at the main campus in East Baltimore, and I also do clinic at the Bartlett Specialty Practice. And today I am joined with Dr. Christina Madison, and I'll have her introduce herself.
Hello, everyone. Again, my name is Dr. Christina Madison. I'm the founder and CEO of The Public Health Pharmacist. I'm also a clinical consultant for the National Clinical Consultation Center.
Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Madison. So these are our disclosures, as well as the disclosures of our guest speakers that we have on video today, as well as the CME Outfitter staff. This is also included in your program guide. So let's get started. We have three objectives that we're going to talk about today. The first objective is to integrate a universal testing approach in clinical practice for hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, and HIV based on evidence-based CDC guidelines to address screening gaps. We do also have some audience response questions. So you can select the answer on your iPad. What percentage of new HIV cases result from individuals who are unaware of their status due to lack of screening? A, 10%, B, 20%, C, 40%, D, 60%, or E, I don't know.
We go.
Great. Good job, everybody. The answer is 40%. So we're going to talk a little bit more about this in the next couple slides. So this is a summary of the global HIV, Hep B, and Hep C epidemics. I'm just going to run through a little bit about some of the key information in this slide. In terms of the epidemic size, hepatitis B is the largest, affecting 296 million people, as opposed to Hep C of 58 million and HIV of 39 million. In terms of new infections per year, hepatitis B and hepatitis C, new infections, 1.5 million for each. HIV is close behind at 1.3 million, but it's actually quite a large number if you think about how smaller size the reported epidemic is, which is 39 million. So deaths per year, unfortunately, people are all dying from these infections, which is why we need to amp up our screening. Hepatitis B, 820,000 deaths per year. HIV at 650,000. And hepatitis C, 290,000. If you think about it, we have a durable cure for Hep C, so we really shouldn't be seeing as many deaths if we can do proper screening and engage these people in treatment. In terms of percentage diagnosed, we're doing well, I think, in HIV at 85%. Unfortunately, screening is not as robust for hepatitis B at only 10%, and hepatitis C at 21%. So we're here to discuss what those kind of barriers are to get people to testing. We can treat patients. HIV has, as we all know, has great antiretroviral regimens, but unfortunately, a fourth of patients are not getting treated. With hepatitis B, only 2.2%. Although I do recognize that per guidelines, not everybody with chronic hepatitis B needs to be treated. In terms of Hep C, very low at 13% of patients treated. We have a robust cure, which we've talked about in this meeting today, and patients should be receiving it. Treatment, we've talked a lot about treatment, I think, already. But cost of treatment isn't really that much. I mean, HIV, less than $50 per year, Hep B, $28, and Hep C, $60. Diagnostic tests, we have widely available diagnostic tests, so we don't have lack of actual tests, and they aren't expensive. The cost is actually quite cheap. We have HIV antibodies, Hep C antibodies, and hepatitis B surface antigen. So we have testing, and it is not expensive. We need to figure out how to get testing to these unique populations. So Dr. Madison is going to go over some unique populations and tell us a little bit about more who's at risk.
Yes, of course. So if we take a look at the global prevalence of HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C by population, looking at this in comparison to, say, our general population, we definitely know that there are certain groups and populations that are at higher risk for potential exposure to these infectious diseases than others. So if we take a look here, just based off of the studies, one of the things that I thought was quite interesting when I looked at this slide is how many studies we have around blood donors and how few the number of cases we have as far as HIV positivity, Hep B positivity, and Hep C positivity in relation to how many studies we have for those blood donations. So when we look here, based off of the populations, who do we see that is really at highest risk for single infection as well as co-infection? So first, one that I want to point out to you is our individuals experiencing homelessness, our same-gender loving population, and our individuals who are currently using drugs. And I also wanted to just point out, when we talk about individuals who are using drugs, we're not just talking about injectable drugs, which I think was something that we really were focusing on during the height of the HIV epidemic and wanting to institute things like harm reduction strategies around needle exchange programs. But we also have to remember that for Hep C, we also have a risk from individuals who do drugs via intranasal, the form of snorting the drug as well. So ultimately, we want to make sure that these populations are being prioritized. I wish I saw more studies on here in relation to those experiencing homelessness and our same gender loving population, especially since we know that those individuals may have issues around polysubstance use, which may increase their risk for having co-infection with HIV, Hep C, as well as hepatitis B. Now that we've heard a little bit more about the statistics, let's turn to culturally inclusive and responsive screenings and care. I'm pleased to introduce my colleague, Asia Sullivan, who is a physician's assistant right here in Los Angeles, who puts this concept into practice every single day. So let's go ahead and roll the tape.
My name is Asia Sullivan. I'm a certified physician assistant here in the Los Angeles area, and our practice does cater to the LGBTQ plus community, but of course we see patients of all walks of life and all sexual orientations and genders. And so in that line of work, screening for infectious disease, including HIV and hepatitis B and C, is some of the bread and butter of what we do every day. We try to incorporate a strategy of pan-viral screening whenever we can. And so to us, that means incorporating screening for these conditions as just part of a normal workup. It's not anything that a patient has to ask for. It's something we offer right off the bat. We try to take like an opt-out testing strategy. So anytime a patient comes in, whether that is for just a routine annual physical or a checkup, as they like to call it, or if they're here specifically for STI screening or concerns about sexual health, that is something we just immediately say, right, okay, we're going to do some blood work. We're going to go ahead and screen you for conditions like HIV and hepatitis and just kind of keep the conversation moving. I would say that's been a really successful strategy. We almost never have patients opt out of that, even if they may not necessarily be a high-risk population. So we just offer this to everyone as part of a routine visit and try to keep it moving, and that's been very successful for us.
So I want to thank Asia for basically segueing so well into this slide, which is about universal screening. These are the CDC recommendations for screening for HIV, Hep B, and Hep C. And what she was describing was this universal approach, not just looking for people at risk or with risk exposures or something that makes you think, oh, this patient got, you know, this virus from this exposure, but really just test everybody. For HIV, all patients recommended ages of 13 to 64 should be screened at least once in a lifetime. Hepatitis B and hepatitis C, all adults ages greater than 18 years should be screened at least once in a lifetime. And the caveat to that is patients who may have periodic risk factors. So they may have risk exposures, and at that time, they should be tested again. So if patients come to you and say, I've used, you know, I'm afraid I may have contracted something, you should test again. So this one-time screening is at least. There can be more times, and you can screen as many times as you need to, regardless of age, and definitely with ongoing exposure risks. All pregnant women, we will talk again about pregnant women at the end, they should be screened for HIV, Hep B, and Hep C, in addition to syphilis with each pregnancy. We're talking about, with testing, not only finding patients who have these diseases, but to prevent transmission. And with pregnancy, we need to prevent transmission. With universal screening, you can reduce the stigma or difficulty in trying to assess which risk factors are associated with which viruses. If we screen everybody, we can reduce transmission and improve outcomes. As the question you guys had just answered in the audience response question, about 15% of individuals with HIV are unaware of their status due to lack of appropriate screening. This leads to nearly 40% of new cases of HIV. So the opt-out approach that Asia was talking about removes stigma. If we can remove the stigma from testing and just tell patients, listen, we test everybody. It doesn't really matter what your background is. We can increase the number of people that are diagnosed and link them into treatment and therefore reduce transmission.
One thing I just wanted to point out really quick with that screening is that the CDC ended it at 64. Yes. And I was wondering, do 65-year-olds not have sex?
Very true.
It's just something to think about. I mean, because, you know, they say, what, 40 is the new 30, 50 is the new... 40?
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to point that out.
That's a good point.
We've had patients in their 70s, in their 80s, actively engaging in a very happy sexual life. So just something to consider.
I think also another point to that is with hepatitis C, if many of us have seen, this is a very indolent infection. Patients aren't feeling symptoms usually until, you know, they have cirrhosis or some manifestations of cirrhosis. So this indolent infection can last many decades, and so you may not diagnose especially with Hep C, you may not diagnose these patients until their 60s and 70s if they haven't been engaged in care.
Yeah, grandma may seem very tame now, but she might have been a wild child back in the 60s. So I want to just take a moment to go through this graphic from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention around status-neutral HIV prevention and care. So we want to prevent and treat syndemic infections. And ultimately, we want to do this with culturally competent and quality care. So regardless of whether or not your patient tests positive or negative for these screenings, we want to link them to care. So if we think about the side that you see on your right, those individuals who test negative for HIV, we want to make sure that we're really supporting them with quality care metrics and have this prevention pathway that is highly impactful. So one of the things that we know from our EHE goals or ending the epidemic is that we can't just focus on current infection. We have to focus on prevention. So people whose HIV tests are negative should be offered powerful prevention tools, not just HIV prevention through an oral pill or a long-acting injection, but other harm reduction strategies, such as barrier methods and supportive care services. And then for those who test positive, we want to immediately link them to care and making sure that they're on something that is an effective treatment so that we can use this concept of treatment as prevention in addition to making sure that they are undetectable, which means untransmittable. So this is a very powerful tool that we can use in order to help our patients to stay adherent to their antiretroviral treatment, as well as, from a public health standpoint, decrease the potential risk of new transmissions. So people whose HIV tests are positive should enter into primary care and are offered effective treatment and supportive services to achieve and maintain viral suppression.
I like the point about, even though they're HIV negative, it doesn't mean you just say, oh, you're negative, bye-bye. You would hopefully try and include this patient, even though they've tested negative, into all these prevention tools that she was talking about. They still need to be engaged in care, regardless of positive or negative.
Yes, it should be a happy dance. That's what I do. I'm like, you're negative, so let's get you on PrEP.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is our second of three objectives. We're going to evaluate panviral testing strategies in diverse practice settings that improve engagement with patients from special populations at risk for HIV or viral hepatitis. We're going to move on to another audience response question. How often do you currently recommend panviral screening for your patients per CDC guidance? A, never, just learning about the CDC recommendations. B, rarely. C, sometimes, depending on risk factors. D, most of the time. Or E, always. Great. Woo-hoo. Excellent. So most of you are in always. I hope to move all the rest of the bars to always as well by the end of this talk. So Dr. Madison, do you want to present this patient case to us?
Yeah, let's go over Daniel. So Daniel is a 57-year-old male, had not received routine medical care for several years due to lack of insurance, which we can all relate to. He engaged in occasional IV drug use in his 30s, but never disclosed this to his healthcare professional. During a routine physical at age 50, his doctor did not, however, recommend hepatitis C viral testing despite the current Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. At age 53, Daniel experienced fatigue and abdominal pain, but attributed it to stress and did not seek medical attention. Well, unfortunately, by the age of 55, Daniel had developed severe symptoms, including jaundice, and was diagnosed with advanced liver disease due to hepatitis C. Further testing revealed he was also HIV positive, which he had unknowingly contracted and likely had transmitted to others. So ultimately, Dr. Moon, do you think this is a case that's emblematic of less than ideal screening?
I think we're all saying yes, right?
Yes.
This is less than ideal. I think many things probably kind of jumped out at you, and probably the first one would be the IV drug use. He definitely has a clear risk factor that puts him at risk for developing viral hepatitis and HIV, but also, you know, not having any insurance. He hasn't seen a provider in many years, so you kind of have to start from scratch and go through their entire history. I know a lot of you are primary providers or even specialists. We have, at the end, people put health maintenance, you know, flu shot, COVID shot, hemoglobin A1C, lipid panel. I think what we need to include in there is panviral testing and make sure everybody gets that as part of their regular health maintenance. And unfortunately, because he hasn't been in the health system, he hasn't had a conversation with his provider about even what viral hepatitis is, what kind of the symptoms are. So when he did develop symptoms, unfortunately, didn't really know what to do and just brushed it under the table.
Yeah, one thing I just wanted to point out is having that really open and honest conversation with your patient and encouraging them to be their authentic selves and really providing a judgment-free zone that allows for them to tell you everything about their history. Because ultimately, if he had disclosed this past history of IV drug use, he potentially may have been screened earlier and could have prevented some unfortunate, long-term complications associated with his Hep C infection. And then ultimately, we may have prevented him from becoming HIV positive as well.
I know it's a terrible kind of cascade of events, which we're trying to prevent. Next, we're going to hear from one of my colleagues, Lee Gilman. He's a nurse practitioner in Johns Hopkins University. He works treating patients with hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV, but also uniquely works on a mobile unit van that goes around Baltimore providing care to people kind of on the ground. He also does some Suboxone treatment as well. So he has a very unique position in meeting people in the community, right kind of where they are. So let's hear from him. Please roll the video.
Essentially, everyone that we see is at risk for a viral infection, such as HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. Even if they do not have histories of injection drug use, a lot of them have multiple risk factors that put them at increased risk, including unstable housing, food insecurity, history of intranasal substance use, history of sort of under the table tattoos, histories of incarceration or tattoos while incarcerated. And so, you know, these are individuals who are at some of the highest risk of viral infection for what we're talking about when we're talking about panviral testing. Those that actually have are infected with the virus and may be, you know, at risk of spreading the virus, as well as poor outcomes from being infected with the virus, there are a lot of challenges to actually making it in the door in clinic. That includes access to transportation, unemployment, housing instability, food instability, histories of trauma and violence, histories of skepticism about the healthcare system or trauma related to the healthcare system, you know, and a lot of them have co-occurring psychiatric or mental health conditions that may be impacting their judgment and able to access care, their overall stability. And then also their addiction and substance use disorders that often take prominence when thinking about their own sort of day-to-day livelihoods. And so lowering the barriers to accessing testing by having more community sites, figuring out ways to have, you know, tests with a blood draw for hepatitis B in more community and mobile settings is really the key to sort of spreading information, but also making people aware and allowing them to access care and treatment.
So Dr. Madison is going to go into that in more depth, talking about these unique populations and how we can get more information from them and how we can do some shared decision making.
Yeah, I really love the fact that he talked about meeting the patient where they are. We have seen, you know, firsthand during the pandemic how important it is to meet the community where they're living. And this is just another example of how we can really move the needle, especially by offering judgment-free testing in a community setting and really talking about it based off of just health and wellness and not specifically talking about it based off of risk. So one of the things that I'm going to be discussing is this shared decision-making through optimal patient care approach. So the first step here is S, or seek. So you want to seek your patient's participation. This should be a shared dialogue. Nothing that we're telling the patient should be something that they don't want. We should be making decisions together about their care. The second step is help, or H, and we want to help our patients explore and compare treatment options. We want to next assess. So this is step three. So we want to assess your patient's values and preferences. We know that based off of everyone's lived experience, they may or may not want to take that health recommendation, especially in communities of color, which may have experienced both historical and generational trauma. The next step, or step four, R, is reach. So we want to reach a decision with our patient. We don't want to bark orders at them. We don't want to tell them things that, you know, they didn't feel like they came to the decision together with us as their provider. And then the last step here, step five, is to evaluate. So we want to evaluate your patient's decision and ultimately let them know that it's their choice, but we are going to be here for them regardless of what they choose. So optimal patient care really starts with that shared clinical decision making. And then we want to take into consideration our patients' values and preferences, what the current scientific evidence is, and then ultimately one of the things that the that Dr. Moon's colleague talked about, the nurse practitioner, are those social drivers of health, such as food and housing insecurity, which ultimately, if you don't know where your next meal is going to come from or where you're going to lay your head at night, medication and taking that medication as directed is not high on your priority list. So, with that being said, talking about these social drivers of health, we know that race and ethnicity, our social network, our financial resources, where we live, because we know our zip code is one of the strongest predictors of whether or not we will be healthy and well, and our life expectancy, as well as health literacy. So all of these things combined will help us when we think about ways that we can implement pan-viral testing and treatment. So how do we ask our patients about these social drivers of health? First and foremost, we want to establish rapport and a good dialogue with our patient. Ultimately, I try to come from a place of shared likes and desires. One of the things that I used to love to do with my patients is talking with them. I live in Las Vegas, so there's always something fun to do, and there's always something social going on. So I usually talk about, you know, if there's a convention in town, or, you know, what entertainment or fun things that they've done. I'm also a lover of fashion, so I tend to talk a lot with my patients about that as well. So some of these things can get rolled into that just general dialogue of trying to establish rapport with your patient. So here are some sample questions that you may want to use. What challenges do you have getting to the appointment? Ultimately, we don't want to penalize our patients, especially if they're taking public transportation or may have challenges with childcare, which may lead them to miss their appointments or be delayed to their appointments. Issues around pharmacy access. So if they do have challenges getting to the pharmacy, maybe switching to a pharmacy that delivers. Do they have access to care in their preferred language? So we always want to make sure that we're offering in-language services. We can do this by using teleinterpreters or having staff members that speak native languages. Do you have insurance for visits and prescriptions? So some folks may have some type of insurance, but the insurance deductible may be very high, and or they may have limited prescription coverage. So this is something that we can refer them to a counselor or a social worker to determine if they may be eligible for a manufacturer's discount or coupon card. Asking around safety. So we do know that some of our patients may be experiencing intimate partner violence, or they may not feel safe at home. So we can do things like home health, visit to assess safety, as well as we're a mandatory reporter, so we should report any issues around abuse. And then, do they have a safe place to store their medications, especially if there's a refrigeration requirement? So giving them things like pill boxes or blister packs. And then, have they experienced any discrimination that's negatively impacted their health? I work very closely with the LGBTQIA+ community, and this was something that I heard often when patients would come into my clinic, was that they had previously experienced discrimination and stigma in a previous office, which is why they decided to come to us. And then ultimately, how do they prefer to learn about things? We want to make sure that we're using their preferred method for learning, especially if they have limited health literacy. And then, do they currently have enough money or access to food? And then determine whether or not they have eligibility for meal assistance, or we could even provide them with resources so that they could seek donations from a food pantry. So these are just some examples of how we can help with these social drivers of health, which we know could negatively impact whether or not someone is going to take our health recommendations. Dr. Moon?
I think if many of you are providers, you know, when we take our history, in social history, a lot of us put tobacco, alcohol, drugs, and maybe sexual contents as well. You need to expand that social history. And so these questions are kind of to prompt you and help you have that discussion with your patients. I think they will also feel valued and that you care so much about them that you want to know this much about how they live, where they're living, who they live with, and what traumas they may be having. That rapport is going to help you not only with just general care, but what we're trying to get at is these populations need that extra care and help. So the testing is very easy to do, but if you can't have this conversation with them, they're not going to keep coming back to you and tell you honest risk exposures and when to retest. And so you may say, oh, I did their testing like 5 years ago, but have you spoken with your patient again to know what's happening in their lives? I think these questions are to help you get talking, and that's why we put them here.
One other point, too, I just wanted to make is that people's circumstances may change. They may have a loss of a job, loss of a family member, loss of income. I see this actually a lot in my individuals that are part of the gender expansive and sexual diverse community, that they may have to turn to what we consider more underground means of employment. Yeah. So we don't want to, you know, poo-poo them or make them feel like they can't honestly talk to us if they do potentially have to engage in commercial sex work in order to provide for their families. So again, having that open and honest dialogue is extremely important.
I think that helps answer, there's a question that came through about commenting on screening for STDs simultaneously. which we definitely should do depending on the history that we're gathering and what you had just brought to our attention. And then another person, they had asked about mobile blood draws to facilitate Hep B testing out in communities at risk is very important, and what can be done, especially in the current environment of federal programs being cut. We had spoke a little bit about this before we started.
Yeah, so engaging with public-private partnerships, I think that things are moving away from maybe federal dollars and more focusing on things that are more hyper-local and looking to our states to help with funding some of those mobile clinics and community outreach.
We do have in Baltimore some mobile clinics about that do provide some testing. I know with hepatitis B, we all know that it needs to be a blood draw. There are some devices that we have that are in other countries but not FDA approved that can do surface antigen testing, in 30 minutes or less. We unfortunately don't have that. We do have Hep C, now point of care testing with just a finger stick, which is coming, which is great because not everyone with a positive Hep C antibody has Hep C. So we are moving towards these things, but if we can get them on mobile units, that would be great. Yeah. So we have another time to hear from Asia, this time on the important role of patient advocacy. Please
roll the tape.
Yeah. Being a clinician and establishing a diagnosis and treatment is only half of the job responsibilities in this setting. And the other half is much more of an advocacy type role. And I think that starts as soon as the patients come through the door, again, not trying to risk stratify them by their drug use history or their sexual behaviors, but rather just kind of treating everyone equal across the board when it comes to screening for these conditions, because it's not only injection drug users or folks with multiple sexual partners who may contract hepatitis or HIV. A lot of patients who may be living with HIV or hepatitis are completely unaware of it. And so that's something that we try to educate them about. You don't know what you don't know. And in terms of establishing a diagnosis, so let's say a patient does end up testing positive for HIV or hepatitis B or C, part of the advocacy work is being able to link them to the proper resources within the community. As we know, sometimes the treatments and medications associated with these conditions can be extremely expensive. So as a patient advocate, we try to be aware of any patient assistance programs that may be able to help them, any community organizations that may be able to, you know, bring them in and reduce the stigma a little bit. We try to let patients know that you are not alone in this condition. Millions of people in the United States are dealing with the same thing, and also address any comorbidities that they may have, including mental health conditions, substance use conditions, and linkage to care from that regard as well.
So important to have that advocacy for your patient so that they feel comfortable with their diagnosis, especially if they do test positive. So the last concept that I would like to address is cultural humility. So the five R's are reflection, respect, regard, relevance, and resiliency. So when we think about reflection, what did I learn from each person in this encounter? So really reflecting on what information you received and how that's going to determine how it's going to reflect your clinical decision making. And then ultimately, we want to respect our patients. Did I treat everyone involved in this encounter respectfully? I think this is really important because, you know, in our day-to-day, we rush, and sometimes it gets to be really challenging, and our workload gets to be very hard. And so we always just want to make sure that we're treating everyone with respect and kindness. And then regard. Did we have any issues with our unconscious biases that drove the interaction? So, you know, making sure that we're coming from a place of, understanding when it comes to someone else's lived experience. And then relevance. How was cultural humility relevant in this interaction? Were you taking that individual's lived experience into consideration when determining what treatment regimens or recommendations you had for that patient? And then lastly, resiliency. How was my personal resilience affected by this interaction? So ultimately, we want people to feel like we are there for them, we're thinking about them, we're here with an empathetic empathetic space to help them to move forward with whatever their test results are when we are conducting this pan-viral screening.
So next we're going to hear about education and trust from Joseph McCray, who's a nurse at the Broadway Center for Addiction at Johns Hopkins University. Please roll the video. Thanks.
The way my health education classes are, I do mix it up some. I talk about diseases, but then I go back to cocaine or opioids. So they're kind of mixed in there. And then with the HIV, I do role playing in the beginning of the class. I give them some scenarios to teach about prevention, teach about testing, teach about living with HIV. Some members in the group will, like the big one they ask about is, or at least they'll bring up, is undetectable. So I do a little visual. I take the desk in our group room and I turn it over and make it like a wall. And then I get under the desk and I say, "Can you see me?" And they say, "No." And I said, "I'm undetectable, right?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah." And I said, "That's what the lab is like. It's undetectable. It's below the level." I said, "But am I still in the room?" And they'll say, "Oh, yeah, yeah." I said, "So I'm still in the room." So the person still has HIV, but their levels are below the testing level. Do you guys get that? Does that make sense? And they'll be like, "Yeah." And I said, "I just need some help to get this desk back up." Yeah, I really want them to get the point. I really want them to get the point. I think one barrier is that sometimes patients will believe that this was all a part of the government. They'll talk about conspiracy theories and how this is population control. So I say to them, I say that, you know, I just try to say, you know, it's not a government conspiracy. And then I give them the number to 1-800-CDC-INFO. And I say to them, you know, pull out your phone, give you this number and ask them, where did HIV come from? You know, where is it strongly believed it comes from? And they pull it all out. And I tell them what the person is going to tell them. But I say, I want you to call also and hear it too. So
this will move now into our last objective, which is about pregnancy and how to incorporate guideline recommended pan-viral screening approaches for patients who are pregnant to improve outcomes and limit perinatal transmission. The next question is, per CDC and ACOG, when should pregnant patients at elevated risk ideally be screened for HIV? Every trimester, first and second trimester, first and third trimesters, or I don't know? Good job, everybody. All right, we can just skip all these slides. Okay.
Yeah.
So according to CDC and American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, all pregnant individuals should be screened for viral infections, including HIV, Hep B, and Hep C, preferably in the first trimester. For patients with an increased risk of HIV, repeat testing is recommended in the third trimester. Early identification of viral infection and rapid introduction of antiretrovirals can significantly reduce vertical transmission. In the absence of antiretrovirals, 25 to 30% chance of vertical transmission in HIV. However, with early viral suppression, this rate can drop to 1 to 2% or less. We're just going to briefly just talk about syphilis screening. The reason is congenital syphilis cases have increased tenfold between 2012 and 2022. 88% of these cases could have been prevented with timely screening and treatment. The ACOG practice advisory from 2024 recommends individuals who are pregnant to be screened serologically for syphilis at three time points: at the first prenatal care visit, during the third trimester, and at birth. And our last speaker is Dr. Martina Bedell, who's a maternal fetal medicine specialist at Emory University. She does research with the CDC and sees patients with hepatitis and HIV.
We know treating HIV in pregnancy with maternal ARVs and infant prophylaxis can significantly reduce the risk of infection. And if we don't know that patients are positive via screening, then we do not have the ability to treat them. For hepatitis B, similarly, we can reduce the risk of transmission if there is maternal viremia by use of antivirals during pregnancy. And additionally, infant Hep B vaccination and immunoglobulin given within the first ideally 12 hours of life. And for hepatitis C, although currently treatment is not recommended during pregnancy, we do make some additional recommendations in pregnancy as far as following viral loads, growth ultrasounds, and avoiding invasive testing during pregnancy, and also for infant screening and linkage to care if positive. In general, we find if patients present for prenatal care that they are open to getting testing for these infections in pregnancy. We also screen for syphilis, and there are a number of other standard labs that are drawn as part of an initial OB visit, including a type and screen, a CBC, and OBGYN providers can normalize the infectious screening in pregnancy by saying it's part of a routine set of labs that are checked in every pregnant person in every pregnancy. I can't remember the last time I had a patient opt out or decline to do screening. An important point about vaccination, hepatitis B vaccination is now recommended universally for all adults. The hepatitis B vaccine is safe in pregnancy. And recently, the two-dose Hep B vaccine has been approved in pregnancy. So when patients are coming for prenatal care, it will be an opportunity to vaccinate. Although most general OB offices don't carry the vaccine, just making sure that you know where, what pharmacies or health departments or ID clinics patients can go to if they're not hepatitis B immune to get hepatitis B vaccination. So I think, you know, if patients have limited or no prenatal care, any touch point they have with a health department, student health, emergency room, these screening tests are, like I said, recommended in pregnancy and could be ordered by any provider as a way to, again, improve both maternal and neonatal health.
One thing I just wanted to point out quickly is that she mentioned that this is when you have regular prenatal care. So when you don't have prenatal care, any touch point with a healthcare professional is going to be impactful, and we could talk about the need for additional screening. So that could be community health, it could be a faith-based organization, health clinic, it could be at the pharmacy, because we do know that there is a large portion of pregnant persons that may not have traditional prenatal screenings, and so we do want to make sure that we're engaging them when we can.
Perfect, and you just did the slide. Early identification of active infections and prompt initiation of treatment to reduce prenatal transmission. Fantastic. So this is the last part before we get into a couple questions. We have a section called SMART goals, which is specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. This is to kind of put what we've learned into action. So consider doing this in your own practice. Try and set a time frame that fits with your work environment and a reasonable improvement target that could align with your patient population. Try and increase the percentage of eligible patients who receive panviral screening. Increase the percentage of patients who participate in shared decision-making regarding panviral testing and subsequent treatment if needed. And improve adherence to CDC and ACOG recommendations for panviral testing and syphilis testing in pregnant patients to reduce vertical transmission. So we just have a few questions, but some of them have been answered here during our presentation. Don't you need to risk stratify to get testing reimbursed? I'm not entirely sure what they're getting at.
So I think part of this is that we need to remember that patients may not always disclose everything. And so if we just look at it from the standpoint of everyone should be receiving these screenings, that kind of takes away the issues around risk stratification. Obviously, some of your patients are going to potentially need to have more frequency of testing, but just the act of testing by itself should not, it shouldn't require risk stratification for payment purposes. This should just be something that you're able to do as far as a regular routine health screening.
Yeah, I practice in Baltimore, and we screen and rescreen and rescreen so many people for various things that they come in and tell us that they've done. And I've never had a rejection for doing a screening and testing for any of these three again and again. Frequently, you'll also find, especially with HIV and Hep C testing, because the testing can be done with a finger stick, there's many community fairs, urgent cares, ERs that will do this testing very easily.
Yeah, you'll often see, especially during times of the year like National HIV Testing Day or Hepatitis Awareness Month, but we also have to remember it's not just one time a year. We should be testing all the time. But you can kind of capitalize on those moments, and you could potentially utilize that as a time to bring awareness to your patient population during those times of the year, and then just remember to remind them, hey, we're here to help you, we're here to test you, and this is something that we can do on a regular basis. And regardless of the result, we're going to be here for you and your family and your community.
Another question was why we need Hep C screening during pregnancy. Hep C can be vertically transmitted, and therefore not just the women should be tested and should be treated after they give birth, because Hep C testing is not approved currently in pregnancy, but also babies can get hepatitis C. However, pediatrics will kind of guide that, because the Hep C antibody can be positive in an infant, and they should be retested after about a year and a half. And Hep C treatments are approved in children, so you can treat kids. So we should screen all our pregnant patients for Hep C. There was another question about if a patient is HIV positive but Hep C and Hep B negative, does that have an impact on your treatment choice when patient admits to being non-adherent to hypertension medications?
So I would say if you have somebody who is HIV positive, one of the things that, because I've been caring for those affected and infected with a positive status for about 20 years, we've seen sort of the difference of kind of moving away from this being very specialized care, very like ID focused, especially during the beginning of the epidemic, we saw a lot of issues around opportunistic infections. This is just another chronic medical condition, right? So I look at HIV positivity and hypertension very similarly, right? Like either one could be mismanaged if your patient isn't adherent to their therapy. And so it's just, again, talking with them about what their why is and trying to determine, is there a reason why they are not taking their therapy? Is it because of those social drivers of health that are impacting their ability to either get access to the pharmacy, they don't have insurance that covers things, they don't know about the discount services that can be done through some of the drug companies or the discount cards, things like Cover My Meds, Single Care, GoodRx, all of those different things. Sometimes people just don't know about them, or they may just have competing priorities like lack of childcare or not having access to food assistance or having challenges with housing. So all of those things combined kind of make it very difficult when you're not sure what your patient's main priority is. So one of the things that I often ask the patient is, what did you want to get out of today's visit? Not what I want, right? So like I can go through a whole host of screenings and things that I want to do, but what do they want to get out of the appointment? Like, because my priority may be very different than their priority. So you want to make sure that that matches and that you're engaging in that shared clinical decision making.
And we have one last question before we let y'all go. They're about point of care testing and at-home testing. So in terms of, we do have point of care for HIV and Hep C that's very readily available. Unfortunately, with Hep C, because the antibody is positive, it doesn't necessarily mean they have Hep C, so you need to do some sort of RNA testing. The FDA has approved Cepheid's point-of-care finger stick for Hep C RNA, which you can get. You just need the machine. So if you have the machine, you can do it. We don't have a machine yet at Hopkins, so if you can get it, that's great. That would be the best, I think. I think that's where things are moving in terms of the care cascade. If you can do a point-of-care test for Hep C RNA and it's positive, you should be able then to hand the patient the drug, and they should take the medication and achieve SVR and be done with it. That's what we would love to happen. So I think that machine will definitely help us. In terms of HIV, once an antibody is positive, they must be linked to care immediately. And Hep B, I think, is what's tricky. It's a blood draw in the U.S., but abroad, there are quicker testing that can be done. Some of them capillary fill, so a finger prick. It's not approved in this country, but they do have rapid testing that can be done through blood samples within 15 to 30 minutes that have been shown in many other countries. So I can't disclose that for here, but it does exist for venous blood draw, though, but it's not a finger prick. That's the trouble. There are also at-home tests. In this country, the validation is a problem. getting those tests validated for home tests and for them to get paid for. That's the difficulty in this country. But there are at-home tests that you can send a triple, it's called like triplex, where you can get HIV, Hep B, and Hep C all done at one time, which they looked at in Congo. They tried to put it in rural communities and see if people could test themselves. And so it is there. It's just, it's a matter of getting it paid for in this country.
There is a free at-home HIV test that is available by the CDC as well. So they launched that last year on HIV, National HIV Testing Day. So you can get that as well. It is just an antibody-only test. Obviously, we want to make sure that when we can, we do antibody antigen. But it's a great first step, and it is no cost to the patient. And they can do the testing in the comfort of their own home, which ultimately could be the difference between someone testing and not testing.
So I'd like to thank Dr. Madison for being with us and providing her expertise today. And I'd like to thank you all for being here and all the team members who provided their recorded perspectives. These recordings are actually much longer interviews that will be available on CMEOutfitters.com. And you may please feel free to access their other resources as well and the full-length interviews. Thank you all for being here. And thanks for listening.